Some of us are outwardly successful, but inwardly feel unhappy and living a life lacking in purpose and meaning. The Necktie and the Jaguar by Carl Greer can help you discover what's important to you and how to go for it. For more information or to purchase the book, visit carlgreer.com. That's CarlGreer.com.
Vox Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Welcome to Vox Novus, the new voice. Are you living your life to the fullest? Do you consider yourself successful? Has your definition of success changed during your life? It's a question we all ask ourselves, yet there is no universal answer. My guest this week on Vox Novus, Dr. Frank Bohm, has curated stories defining success from more than 200 people, including figures like former Senator Bob Corker and singer-songwriter Tanya Tucker, to nurses, lawyers, Uber drivers, those with special needs, people experiencing homelessness, and more. Dr. Frank Bohm retired from a 50-year practice, as well as being a professor and vice chair of the Obstetrics and Gynecology Department of Vanderbilt University Medical Center. He joins me this week to share his path and new book, Is Your Life Successful? Answers and Anecdotes from Over 200 Everyday People. Please join me in welcoming to Vox Novus Dr. Frank Bohm. Welcome, Dr. Bohm.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you told me I could call you Frank, and I will. So, Frank, please share your path and how it led to your career in medicine.
Well, when I was in college, I was interested in chemistry and realized that that was a good path to pre-med. Went to medical school and absolutely loved studying medicine. And I did a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at Yale New Haven Hospital back in the 60s, and came back to Nashville after a couple of years in the Navy to join the faculty at Vanderbilt University, and was in the Department of OBGYN and served as director of the maternal fetal medicine division there, and then eventually vice chairman of the department. And I just retired a couple of years ago after 47 years at Vanderbilt.
Wonderful. Before we discuss your new book, Is Your Life Successful? Let's share with our listeners a couple of your previous works, starting with Building Patient-Doctor Trust. What inspired this book, and what should readers take away from it?
Well, I've always thought that trust was the glue that held the physician and the patient together. Of course, it's the glue that holds all human interactions together. But in particular in medicine, a patient has to feel that they trust their healthcare provider, their doctor, their nurse, whoever. And I taught a course in the med school called Bedside Manners. And we went into rooms and we talked to patients, and I explained to the students the things that they could do to demonstrate the fact that the patient could trust them. Because trust takes time to build, doesn't happen overnight. And I thought there were things that could be done by the doctor as well as the patient. In particular, the physician needed to let the patient know a little bit about who they are. In my first book, Doctors Cry Too, that was a book that showed the heart of a physician. Because if you understood the heart of a physician, then you were more likely to trust that doctor. You know, the ultimate trust, I guess, is when you sit on an airplane, strap yourself in, you don't meet the pilots, but you trust the pilot. Why do you trust the pilot? Well, because if you go down, they go down. So there's a certain amount of trust. But in a physician-patient relationship, that's not the case. If something terrible happens, the physician may feel terrible about it, but that physician will go home to his or her family. So trust to me was one of the most important aspects of the patient-physician relationship. And so I penned a book about that.
My life has been graced with many wonderful and caring doctors, such as yourself, who approach their patients with warmth and emotional intelligence. As with any cross-section of humanity, I've also encountered doctors who lacked in those areas. Is that something that's now being taught in medical schools?
It is, and that's actually what my course was all about, and I think it's being taught in almost all the other medical schools as well. There are things you can do for people who may not have the wiring, so to speak, to demonstrate their caring. That's actually what my first book was about, because not all physicians demonstrate a warm and fuzzy part of themselves. And so you actually have to teach young men and women how to do that, how to touch the patient, how to put your arm around a patient and to say, I care about you. I want to help you. I'll do everything I can to try to bring you back to good health. There are ways to do it in the office. There are ways to do it in the hospital. And I think that those are important tools that will help build that trust. So not every physician comes to the bedside or to the operating room or to the office with those kind of attributes. But you can teach certain tricks to people. They can learn what it will take to make a patient feel comfortable.
And as the old expression says, we're given two ears and one mouth, listen twice and speak once. Really, listening is the key, isn't it?
Listening and hearing. You know, I hear you is something that I think physicians ought to say once in a while. Or tell me more about this. I hear what you're saying, but I need more information. Demonstrating a certain amount of caring is not always easy, but it can be done by simple maneuvers. For example, I teach the students when they come into the office or into the room in the hospital, pull up a chair and sit down and cross your legs. And the students will say, well, Dr. Bone, why should you cross your legs? But when you cross your leg, you're sending a message to the patient that you're not getting up. It's impossible to stand up with your legs crossed. So that little demonstration of I'm here, I'm not going anywhere, as opposed to standing and sort of moving toward the door, you give the impression that you really are there for them. And those are the kind of little tricks that you can use to show patients that you're there for them, that you're listening, and that you're caring.
Absolutely. As you mentioned, your first book, published in 2001, was Doctors Cry 2, Essays from the Heart of a Physician. What were some of the experiences you shared that brought you to tears?
Well, there were many. There were many. The title comes actually from a case that I was involved in as a resident, where I was operating with this private physician in which the baby was born stillborn. It was alive when it came in, but the patient separated her placenta in what's called an abruptio placenta. And by the time we got her to the operating room and delivered the baby in an emergency manner, the baby was stillborn. And while we were working on the mother, she had what's called an embolism, and she died. And so now this incredible event had to be told to the husband and her parents who were waiting in the waiting room expecting a good outcome. And I remember going into that room and the physician explaining what happened. He did it in a nice way. Don't remember any emotion or anything, but he was so sorry. And they, of course, collapsed. And I couldn't hold back the tears. I cry easily. And the mother of this woman came up to me, put her arm around me and said, when she saw the tears, she said, Doctor, I know you did everything you could. I mean, she was comforting me where I was supposed to be there to comfort her. And when I went back to the on-call room where all the doctors hung out, I heard sort of a sobbing in the bedroom area. I pushed the door open, and there I saw that private physician with his head down against one of the bunk beds, literally sobbing. And I thought to myself, you know, there are more people like me who care and who really have a lot of emotions, but they don't necessarily show it when they're talking to the patient. And I came up with that phrase, doctors cry too. And that was a signature moment for me in medicine.
This leads to a greater question, and perhaps one that is more relevant considering the pandemic. From your 47 years in medicine, how did doctors, physicians' assistants, nurses, and other frontline staffers process grief, that of patient families and their own?
Well, you know, it's not taught to them, and frequently it's a real problem, especially during this last few years with COVID. Grief is difficult. Many of my teachers when I was in med school back in the 60s would say, well, Frank, you can't get too close to patients. You can't take this home. It'll worry you too much. It'll bother you too much. It'll burn you out. Stay a little bit detached. And I thought to myself, that's impossible for me. There is no way that I can divorce myself from what my patients are going through. And I felt their pain, I felt their happiness, I felt their sorrow, I felt their grief. And I think if you can demonstrate that to the patient with an open kind of conversation, being very transparent with the people that you're talking to, I think it helps. Of course, having a support system at home helps. And sometimes physicians need therapy. We have at Vanderbilt, as does almost every hospital in this country, individuals whose job is to work with healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, therapists, to help them with their grief. It's not easy. I just met, even though I'm retired, I still do some mentoring. I just met with one of my old partners. He's still young, but he was in the middle of dealing with significant grief about a baby he delivered. And we spent 2 hours there at lunch talking about that. And I think at the end, he felt better. But it is a process. It takes time. It's not easy. And a lot of patients don't understand how deeply physicians and nurses, other providers, care about their patient. We don't really worry about lawsuits. We worry about good outcomes because we're empathetic individuals who chose a field like none other. There just isn't another profession like medicine.
Absolutely. I read a beautiful and inspirational article you wrote for the Tennessean back in 2016 about your grandson, Seth, who, if I'm not mistaken, recently turned 18. Please share with our listeners about Seth.
Well, you have to understand that as a high-risk obstetrician, I dealt with literally thousands of patients who came to me for genetic counseling, wanting to know if their baby had any type of genetic issue. One of those issues, a big part of that was, does my child have Down syndrome? And so I've spent sort of a career doing tests, looking for that, ultrasound, amniocentesis, chorionic villus sampling, and the like. And my middle son, his wife had a twin pregnancy. And at birth, the little girl was typical. And Seth was born with Down syndrome. And it really hit me hard. It took me about 24 hours to digest this and to understand what this meant for our family. But after about 24 hours, I felt emboldened, and I felt love, and I felt excited. And that's basically been the way it has been for the last 18 years. Seth brings to the table a certain amount of love in his eyes, and his caring for other people. And I wrote this article because in my eyes, Seth was perfect. People would always ask me, is my baby perfect? And I would say, well, as best I can tell, we don't see any anomalies. There's nothing to suggest otherwise. Because people want to know, is their child perfect? And I use that word to describe Seth, because to me, Seth is perfect. He is God's gift to the world, to us and our family. And he has enriched our family.
Absolutely. Your new book is Your Life Successful? Answers and Anecdotes from Over 200 Everyday People. What inspired that book?
Well, you know, I'm 81 now. And a few years ago, when I was thinking about retiring, which I did a few years ago, I thought to myself, have I been successful? And my first answer was, well, of course. I mean, I've been a physician for a little over 50 years. I had a wonderful career at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. I had three wonderful children who were happily married. I had 9 grandchildren. I had a fabulous marriage, a wife who I adored. I had great friends. What more was there to this question that I kept asking myself? And yet, I just wasn't satisfied. I felt like I needed a more objective answer, or at least an objective definition. Webster certainly didn't help me, because Webster really only said something like accomplishing an aim or a purpose, having achieved popularity, profit, or distinction. And that left me a little cold. So I came up with a couple of definitions. One was an objective one, and one was a subjective one. And as I started to ask people whether they felt that their life was successful, I then broached the question, what is your definition of success? What is your definition of a successful life? And a lot of people said, well, you know, Frank, I never really thought about it. Let me think about it. I'll get back to you. Or they would sit down for an hour and let me interview them. And it really resulted in me learning a great deal about people's definition of a successful life. It is almost as varied as our DNA. In other words, people are as individualistic in their definition as they are in their own DNA, because there's so many different definitions that have nothing to do with what Webster had to say. And the more I asked people, I said, you know, this might be a good book. The two types of definitions I had was, one was objective and one was subjective. The objective was, if you believe that you had maximized your genetic potential and your environmental influences, or at least been able to minimize the negativity of your genetic potential and environmental influences. That was more objective. The subjective, which is where patients, where individuals who I interviewed went, were things like love, family, friends, making the world a better place, and a whole list of other types of definitions that I hadn't even thought about. Things like success by proxy. When I interviewed some homeless people, one in particular used the definition by saying, if my 7-year-old boy can finish high school and get a job and get married and have a few kids and have some friends, I feel like I will have been successful. She didn't have to be successful in any way, but if her son was, she would feel success. And I termed that success by proxy. And as a matter of fact, in chapter 6, when I give the reader my own definition of a successful life, success by proxy was one of my definitions.
So let's look at your definitions right now. You had mentioned that you approached it from the objective and subjective standpoint. What did you find as your definitions?
Well, I took the objective first. Was I able to maximize my genetic potential? And I really thought I had. And I told the story of my father and my mother, who immigrated from Germany in 1938 to escape Hitler. They came to America and to Nashville, Tennessee, because my father had a cousin who had a clothing store, and he was able to have him sign an affidavit to allow him to come to America. My father was gifted with what I call vision. He was able to see something that a lot of people didn't. A lot of German Jews stayed in Germany, including most of my dad's family, and were killed by the Nazis. But yet my father had vision to see what was going to happen, and left the country that he loved, that all of his ancestors had come from, and came to a strange country, not speaking English, leaving all of his family behind, except for his wife, my mother. And I thought that was incredibly wonderful of him. But I realized that it was that he had vision. And I really believe that that vision is embedded in his DNA, and therefore embedded in mine as well. And throughout my life, I could give examples, and I do in the book, of how I think the vision that he gave me allowed me to do certain things that maybe I wouldn't have done had his vision not been embedded in my DNA. There's so much about DNA we don't know. Of the 3 billion base pairs, you know, we've identified maybe 20% of what it's all there for. It's certainly not junk. And so much of it determines how we act, how we feel, what we do, what we're interested in. And I thought vision was one of those. And so I thought the fact that my father gave me that I was able to maximize on my genetic potential. And that was the objective definition. The subjective had to do, in my case, with my family. Being loved and loving is really a gift. And my definition, subjectively, was to have that. And I have it. I have a marriage that now is 35 years. It's a beautiful, loving relationship. My children are all happy. And I felt that knowing that I have all that love in my life was really one of my definitions. And of course, the third definition, and people, by the way, didn't just give one definition. They frequently gave more than one. One individual gave me 9 definitions. But the other one, in my case, was to have made this a better world. As a matter of fact, that definition, making the world a better place for others, is really the most popular definition of them all. It was the second most common definition in the young people. It was also the second definition in people who I called older. And it was number one in the maturing age, 25 to 70 to 50, and in the mature, 50 to 75. And so that was part of my definition, that I had created things that made the world a better place. And then finally, the fourth definition for me was success by proxy.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. My guest is Dr. Frank Boehm. His book is called, Is Your Life Successful? Answers and Anecdotes from Over 200 Everyday People. Frank, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Well, they can always go to Amazon to get the book. They can also pick it up at their local bookstores, or they can go to the turnerpublishing.com and order it, or they can go to, I think, Turner Bookstore, and Amazon would be the best ways to get it.
And we'll be back with more of Dr. Frank Boehm and Is Your Life Successful after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times. Co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Dad, I picked up your pills, made your lunch, and your laundry is done.
When you care for a loved one, you take care of everything. But are you taking care of yourself? Find free care guides at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Dr. Frank Boehm. His book is called, Is Your Life Successful? Answers and Anecdotes from Over 200 Everyday People. Frank, what criteria did you use for selecting those that you interviewed and included in the book?
Well, I wanted to get interviews and definitions from a wide variety of people. Obviously, I have a lot of good friends that I spoke to, family members, people that I knew socially. But then I extended that to homeless people. I went down to the shelters in Nashville. I used to be on the Metropolitan Social Service Commission, so I for 10 years, and I worked with a lot of homeless people and significant poverty. And so I interviewed a number of these individuals because I wanted to know what their definition was. And then I also wanted to interview firemen. So I went to firehouses and walked in and said, I'm writing a book. I'd like to interview some of you to get your definition. Almost everybody was very willing to sit down and talk to me. I did the same thing in police stations. I interviewed Uber drivers and Lyft drivers, nurses, secretaries, administrators. I also wanted to talk to famous people as well. I wanted to talk to individuals who were physically disabled or intellectually challenged. I interviewed several people who had stage 4 cancer and who were close to death. And matter of fact, several of the people I interviewed did die by the time the book was published. So I tried to get a wide swath of individuals rather than to narrow it down to just people who, you know, all had money and who might have given me one particular type of definition. And what I found was that the number of types of definitions was incredibly different. It varied so much based on what a person went through. One of my better example was this woman named Rose who lived in the condominium that I live in Boca Raton, Florida, on the beach. And I asked her what her definition was, and she just said, well, it's the, if I have the necessities of life. And I said, what would that be? Thinking she would say a nice car and a boat and a country club membership. She said, no, it's having enough money to pay for rent and food and gas in my car to be able to go to work. And when I gave her an inquisitive look, she said, look, Frank, when I was 21 years old, I was homeless and I lived in my car for 6 months. No matter how much I have now, that'll always be my definition, because I learned then that that really was, for me, a successful life, to be able to have enough money to pay the rent, to have food on the table, and enough gas to get to my place of work. So much is dependent on what's happened to you. Individuals who had lost a child said the definition is so different now that one of their children had died. So it really did vary a lot, but I wanted to get as many different types of people as I could, and I hope I've been successful.
Now, you have more than 200 in the book. How many did you actually interview?
Oh, it was at least a half, but even the ones that sent in their emails, they would say to me, well, you know, Frank, I'd like to think about it, and let me send it to you by email. And then after I got it, I would call them and fill in the blanks. So basically, in many ways, I probably interviewed at least 2/3, maybe 3/4 of them. But I would say close to 100 sent it in to me after they had considered it.
And how did you select those that you feature in the book?
Well, I thought the ones that were the most interesting, that weren't too that didn't duplicate things too much. In the chapter on the young, I think I had something like 35 or 40 teenagers, and they gave me some one-liners. So I didn't really interview them, as they just sent in their definition. But most everyone else, I chose because they said something that I thought was unique. So I didn't want 10 of the same definitions. Remember, this is not a scientific book. It's not a scientific study. It's all pretty much anecdote. When you're in academic medicine, like I was for so many years, there's an axiom that goes like this: the plural of anecdote is not data. So I didn't want to confuse people to think that I'd done some kind of a study. But there's a lot to be learned from these definitions. And I think I found enough outlier definitions to make it what I think very interesting. For example, one woman who had been to Iraq and had so many friends who had PTSD and had committed suicide and so forth. Her definition of a successful life was, if I can live my life and have be in the right mind. And when I asked her about it, she said, look, that's it. I've seen so many of my friends who are not in their right mind and their lives are just so messed up. If I can just avoid that, then I'll think my life is successful. I had another individual said, well, if I can die well, I don't want to die in pain. I want to die well. I said, is that your definition? Yes. Mm. One woman said, my definition is being happily married, having a wonderful spouse. And I said, well, anything else? She said, no, that's basically it. So it's such an individualistic thing that it's hard to group into categories. But what really excited me, and I came to realize that because each person comes to that definition from their life's experience and in some cases their age, because it does change as we get older, based on the premise that, you know, good judgment comes from experience and experience comes from bad judgment. The answers I got from 80-year-olds was different than the ones I got from 25-year-olds. So it was all a very interesting process to read or to learn about these completely different definitions from individuals, often in the same socioeconomic groups.
Can you give us a couple of examples of the definitions that changed with age?
Well, one young man, social worker, said that when he was a teenager, a successful life was to have the right tennis shoes and play a good game of basketball. He said, I got older and I was got accepted to college. My definition then was to be able to do well in college, graduate, and go on and perhaps get further educated, which he did. So he met his definition. He said, then I got married and we had a child. All of a sudden, my definition changed. Now it was to be able to take care of my wife and my child and to experience the love that comes from that kind of a relationship. And I said, anything else? He said, yeah, now my definition of a successful life, which, by the way, I have not met yet, is to make this world a better place. Mm-hmm. That's a good example. Senator Bob Corker told me that as he got older, it changed also. He was, at first, he was a businessman. He wanted to be financially successful. And that changed as he got older. He wanted to do for society. He wanted to help make this a better world. So I think it does depend often on age. Not always, but frequently.
Is the concept of success different now than it was, let's say, in the second half of the 20th century?
Oh, I don't think it's been different probably since humans began to walk the face of the earth, although they may not have had the same experiences. I think human beings, by and large, are really good people. The people I interviewed, so many of them wanted to help other people. And I realized that the bar doesn't need to be set very high to make this a better world. Things like mentoring somebody who goes on to become a physician and help other people. Well, that person who mentored that young man or woman who became a physician, that helped make the world a better place. Or helping old people across the street, or working at a food bank, or even having a garden and growing vegetables and then bringing that to people who are hungry. There are so many different ways to make this world a better place. And people really want to do that. They want to feel like their life has had meaning. And I got that from so many people, even those who would put other things first, eventually got to the fact that, well, you know, Dr. Bohm, I would really like to make this a better world and hope that I can do that.
Acts of kindness.
Yes.
Absolutely.
People are generally kind. I mean, we get bombarded in the news about all the people who are not kind and who are pretty outrageously cruel. That just, I guess, has been part of human behavior ever since mankind started to walk this face of the earth. But I think the vast majority of people, there is kindness and there is caring. And given an opportunity, I think they'll demonstrate that.
You mentioned Senator Bob Corker. Who were some of the other well-known people you interviewed for the book, and how did they define success?
Well, I interviewed Tanya Tucker, the singer. I was her obstetrician and delivered her three children, and we've been friends over the years. So I called her one day and said, I'd love to interview her for my book. And she, we sat for about an hour talking about it. And I eventually said, does fame play a part in your success? Because she had not mentioned it, nor had she mentioned money. She said, no, it really didn't. Fame allowed her to be able to do the things that she felt made her successful. And I said, like what? She says, I want to help other people. I want to give my money, my resources, my time to helping individuals who are suffering. And her line was, I want to make a living out of giving. Mm. And fame only just gave her the opportunity to do those things. Crystal Gale, who I've known for years, also said the very same thing. Yes, she's been rewarded handsomely for her work, but that didn't define her definition at all. It was to be able to be with her loving family, to help others, to do things for society. Senator Bill Frist pretty much said the same thing. Fame just did not do it. And as a matter of fact, Bill Frist made an interesting comment because he was a heart transplant at Vanderbilt where I met him, because he was on my ethics committee for years, and so we became friends. And I said, why did you leave medicine? He said, well, with medicine, I was able to help people one at a time. He said, but when I got into government, became a senator, all of a sudden, I could help large numbers of people. And he wanted to help as many people as possible, and that meant getting involved in politics. So he took it to a degree that maybe other physicians wouldn't, but that was where his empathy lay. He wanted to be able to help a very large number of people rather than just do it on a one-on-one basis.
Did any of those that you interviewed surprise you with what they considered success?
I interviewed current Congressman Jim Cooper, and Jim had recently lost his spouse, and he talked about wanting to give back to society and said things that I'm trying to remember exactly his wording, but he was unique in his desire to not only make this world a better place, but to be a role model and to be a family person for his children. But I don't think I was surprised. I got to the point where almost nothing surprised me because I was expecting a completely varied response. For example, I interviewed a woman who was paraplegic, and her definition was to be able to do things on my own without people helping me. Same thing was true with a young man, James Presley, who had autism and who was in a home in Kentucky. And I interviewed him one day at my house when his father came along. And when I asked him what his definition was, he said, if I'm able to brush my teeth and brush my hair and fix my bed and clean my room and help out in the home, I will feel as if my life has been successful. That's very unique and surprised me a little bit. I interviewed a young gentleman in his 30s with Down syndrome, and his definition was that if I can have wonderful memories of being with friends and family, that was it. I asked him if he had anything else. He said, no, that's basically it. So much depended on what kind of life you had led, the experiences that you'd had. Their definitions were unique and different. And I think that's what makes the book interesting to me, because I came up with 12 conclusions, some of which I've mentioned, such as money and fame really don't define it. Nobody mentioned money. I mean, the extreme poor, they're just surviving. So money was important, but they didn't really have a definition. Their whole role in life was to survive. Where were they going to sleep? Where were they going to get their next meal? But even these individuals who were suffering severe poverty, who were homeless, who were on the streets, said things that really interested me. Because, for example, Dan told me that he was already successful despite the fact that he was living in a homeless shelter. When I asked him how he could say that, he said, well, I use the money that people give me on the streets and I buy acrylic painting and canvas and I paint, and then people walk by me as I'm on the street and buy my paintings. Every time somebody buys one of my paintings, and by the way, I saw one of his paintings and he was quite good, I feel successful. So yes, I'm sleeping in a shelter, but I feel as if my life is already successful because when I got out of prison, I took risks. I'm no longer in prison. My life has turned around and I'm doing something that I love, which is painting, and people are rewarding me. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm already successful. What a wonderful story to hear.
What a beautiful story. And thank you for sharing that. My guest is Dr. Frank Boehm. His book is called, Is Your Life Successful? We'll be back with more after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
It's time for today's STEM tip. Okay, you know recycling is important. No one wants plastic in the ocean. Here's a cool way to repurpose a plastic bottle. Build an awesome terrarium. Cut a large plastic bottle in half and fill the base with sand, pebbles, potting soil, and your favorite plant. I chose an African violet. Put the top of the bottle over your base and place it in the sun. Your plant will grow sealed in its own ecosystem. Fun, right? Learn more at SheCanSTEM. A message from the Ad Council.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up, like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does. Especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at AutismSpeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Dr. Frank Boehm. His book is called, Is Your Life Successful? Answers and Anecdotes from Over 200 Everyday People. Frank, I'm going to share something about my son that I think you will resonate with. He's just turned 30 this week, and I met him when he was six, when his mother, who is now my wife, brought him to functions at an organization that we were both part of. Here was this amazing young man with one leg and propelling himself around with crutches and a rollerblade and a huge smile on his face. When his mother and I got closer, she shared that he was born with Vater syndrome, or what's known as voctural association, which I'm sure you're aware of. He faced many challenges in the first years of his life, but overcame every one of them, and today works in radio production, has his own podcast, is in a wonderful relationship, and sails through New York City on crutches and a rollerblade. For our family and those he inspires, he defines success. So thank you for letting me share that.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Thank you. I had a wonderful spiritual teacher who shared that for life to be successful, there must be purpose, and that purpose should transcend, if possible, the needs of self. How many people shared that?
Lots of people. Lots of people talked about having a meaningful life, having a purposeful life. And I realized that you really didn't have to have a lot of wealth or have an incredibly important job. As a matter of fact, I wrote in the book that for some it might not seem possible to achieve a successful life because of these numerous obstacles, like your son, that might impede their ability to feel as if their life had been worthwhile and meaningful. But even with interfering obstacles, there are ways for many to create a definition for the life that they have lived. For example, a life of illness can still be a life filled with friends and faith. A life of disability can still be a life filled with gratefulness and pride in what one has been able to accomplish. A life of loss or sorrow can still be a life filled with helping others and making this world a better place. A life of poverty can still be a life filled with pride by raising children who accomplish a successful life on their own. And a life of meaningless employment can still be a life filled with family, friends, and faith. So I think that I came away after interviewing all these people with the thought that most individuals, once they sit down and write down their definition of a successful life, whatever the age, will realize that by the time their life is over, that in fact they did live a life that was successful. It is not just for the rich and famous. It is not just those who have gained popularity or fame of some kind. It's everyday people living everyday lives. I mean, if you think about, for example, a young boy, which is a story I had, whose mother was a crackhead who lived in a neighborhood of drugs and gangs and prostitutes, but who somehow walked a few blocks away and got himself into a boys' club, had a mentor. The mentor worked with him for years. He graduated high school, went to a trade school, married his high school sweetheart, had a couple of kids. Saturday nights, they went to the pub and drank beer with their friends. 4th of July, cooked out in the back having hamburgers. And when asked if he had a successful life, he said, absolutely. That might not be everybody's definition, but he was able to certainly maximize his genetic potential. If not that, he would at least minimize the negative genetic potential. So I think it's a kind of thing that most people can conclude that in fact their life had been successful, but they got to think about it. Because I think most people don't think about it. Hell, I didn't think about it until I was about 75, 76 years old. We think about a lot of things, we measure a lot of things, but I don't think we spend much time asking ourselves, what is our definition of a successful life? And am I on the right path to achieve it? Or, depending on the age, have I achieved it?
Pete Townsend of the rock group The Who wrote a song called Pure and Easy. The lyrics said, in part, "We all know success when we all find our own dreams, and our love is enough to knock down any walls." Do you envision a future where the recognition of individual success in all forms and on all levels will lead to greater compassion and acceptance for humanity?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we humans are evolving into, I think, a better individual. I know things are bad now, but if you go back 50 years, in many ways, they were a lot worse. People are evolving, for whatever reason, into individuals who seem to care about what happens to other people. Yes, we still have the fringe groups that dominate the news, But I'm an optimist. I believe in human nature, and I believe in the goodness of people. And so I think we are heading toward a more perfect world where people will care more about others. It's going to take time, and certainly I'm not going to see that. Probably any of the listeners will. But I think we're heading that way. And that, to me, is a very comforting feeling.
You share in Is Your Life Successful? About how the choices we make may dramatically alter our paths and how some recognize an inner guidance based on these choices. From your personal experience and the interviews you conducted, how may we tap into that inner guidance?
Well, there are many ways to tap into it. I've always used my religion to tap into it. When I walk into my synagogue, there's a peace that comes over me, and it's an opportunity to reflect on life and what I need to do to improve myself, to try to understand who I am and where I'm going and what I want to do. And I can do that, by the way, on my nature walks. Twice a week, I go bird watching here at a beautiful lake in Nashville called Radnor Lake. And that hour that I walk around the lake looking at birds brings me into contact with an inner spirit. Because I believe that the God that I pray to resides within me. And I can feel that presence in me. And it gives me a great deal of peace and comfort. And I can get that in my walk around Radnor Lake. I can get it walking into my synagogue. We have to get away from the noise of emails and phone calls and our obsession with our phones that we carry with us and feel lost when we leave it at home or forget it for some reason, can't find it. We've got to spend a little bit more pensive time. We need to think, we need to feel. And I exercise by swimming. And one of the reasons I love swimming is nobody talks to me while I'm swimming my laps. I'm all by myself, and it's almost as if I'm bird watching or sitting in synagogue listening to our cantor sing a beautiful song. I am moved by the spirituality within me. And I think more people need to try to get in touch with that spirituality. I think it'll not only bring them peace, but it'll also give them a much better life.
Absolutely. We discussed your first book, Doctors Cry Too, and in Is Your Life Successful? You share that the process of writing gave you deep joy and a sense of success, and in your words, that was mitigated when the book was complete. In essence, as has been stated by so many, the journey is more important than the destination. Is the privilege of taking the journey of life, no matter the destination, the ultimate success?
Absolutely. I mean, I talk about this in the book. This Simon Sinek wrote about a group of entrepreneurs, very extremely wealthy entrepreneurs that met once a year outside of Boston at MIT. And they were asked a question, how many of you feel financially successful? And almost all the hands went up. And the speaker said, well, keep your hand up if you also feel successful. And 80% of the individuals in the room put their hands down. In other words, they'd become successful financially, but they didn't feel successful. So the process of life, the experiences that we have is really the fun part. As long as we go through it without being on autopilot. You know, I tell a story about this one patient I had who told me that the best thing that ever happened in her life was the day they told her she had cancer. Well, I was just incredulous. How could you say that? And she said, well, before that, I went through life like when you drive home and you don't remember the drive until you get into your driveway and you think, how did I get here? You don't remember the stop signs and the red lights. We've all done that. And yet she said, I went through life like that. I don't go through life that way anymore. And the last 5 years have been enriched by smelling flowers, tasting foods, hugging my kids, thinking about loving my family. I no longer am on autopilot in life. I am now living life and feeling life and experiencing life. That's the joy. And at the end, you can look back, perhaps, and make a definition. And I would imagine that that individual would say, my life has been successful.
Absolutely. As I had mentioned to you, I had the privilege of having a wonderful teacher and mentor and friend, Rabbi Joseph Gelberman, who was the founder of the New Seminary for Interfaith Studies in 1981. I met him in 1995 when I enrolled in the New Seminary, and he was 84 at the time. And he used to share that he'd wake up every morning, feel pain throughout his body, especially his legs, and he'd say, praise God. And people would say to him, you wake up in pain, why are you praising God? He said, because if I felt nothing, I would be dead. And by feeling, I'm alive, and I have another day in which I can do work in this world. So I guess that's the attitude that we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I've found is the nice thing about getting older, and you know, now that I'm 81, the thing that really has impressed me is the wisdom that comes with age.
Yeah.
As you get older, you get wiser. I don't make the same mistakes. I make very few mistakes. I understand things better. I know what it is that brings me pleasure. I know things that I should do, need to do, and then do. So even though there's the shoulder that hurts and the back that aches and all the things that come along with old age, I think it's made up by the fact that the wisdom seeps through your body and allows you to understand life and therefore be able to let go of it, knowing that you've lived a rich life while you were on earth.
The wisdom of Dr. Frank Baum. His book is called, Is Your Life Successful? Answers and Anecdotes from Over 200 Everyday People. Frank, please tell our listeners one more time where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Well, they can go to Amazon or their bookstore. They'll be glad to order it. Or you can just click on to Turner Publishing.
Frank, thank you for bringing us your message. I think it's really important in our world today.
Thank you for this hour. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
And thank you for joining us on Vox Novus. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.